40. Right now, some fog in the area. Headlights on for safety. 37 degrees Kenosha, 36 for Racine. It's 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It's always fun to delve into the marvelous world of history. And I am doing so today with someone paying her first visit to the Morning Show, Dr. Elizabeth Brownson, who is an associate professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. And although Professor Brownson and I have never met until just now, we share a couple of things in common, a love of history, me very much as an amateur. She, of course, is a historian, but also the fact that we have both done some work with Parkside's wonderful series called Adventures in Lifelong Learning. And what a wonderful opportunity that is for people to delve into various topics of interest, maybe things that they are entering for the very, very first time in their lives, sometimes exploring topics that have already been of interest, but exploring different facets of it in a thorough way and in a really vibrant community of learners. And I know that I have very much appreciated each and every opportunity I've had to present in the series Adventures in Lifelong Learning, as has Dr. Elizabeth Brownson. And her next presentation is coming up 2 weeks from today, on Thursday, February 8th. It is a one-day course and or presentation involving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And so we're going to be talking today on the Morning Show about Professor Brownson's interest, not only in history in general, but in particular, the complicated and often tumultuous history of this part of the world. Dr. Elizabeth Brownson, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm really glad we can have this conversation. Ahead of us, kind of digging into the matter of the Middle East and the many conflicts there, including the current conflict, which I know you'll be exploring in your presentation on February 8th, I'd love to know a little bit more about your sort of long-term history in interest in history in general. Can we trace that back to very, very early in your life and to anything in particular?
I remember the first time I wanted to study history as a profession. It was not in high school. I don't think I had any professors or teachers in high school that really caught my attention. And I hadn't had a chance to study world history before college. So when I was in my sophomore year, I had a world history professor who just knew everything about everything. And he'd been all over the place, and he was just fascinating. And I was only a sophomore. I was an undeclared major. And so I decided right then and there to become a history major. And I was really interested in world history, a little more other parts of the world, a little more than the U.S. And I took as many classes. I took a lot of classes on East Asia, China, the Middle East. And I just couldn't get enough of it.
Hmm. Where was that? Where were you studying?
So that was at Colorado State in Fort Collins. Hmm. And the first time I took a Middle Eastern history course was actually at U of I in Champaign. I had come for my junior year for kind of personal reasons, but I took my first class on Islam in that year. So I was a junior. It was called Women in Muslim Societies. And I could not believe that everything I thought I knew about Islam as a religion, everything I thought I knew about the Middle East and Arab women and Middle Eastern women was just pretty much wrong. And I was kind of amazed how little I knew. And so I kept taking courses. I took some on the modern Middle East and early Islam and Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And then eventually decided to go to graduate school.
Very good. So you have been at the University of Wisconsin Parkside since 2012. And in the courses that you have taught, has there been this tilt towards the Middle East? I mean, when Parkside hired you, was it in a sense a conscious choice on their part to have somebody who has this particular expertise?
It was. I was hired as a Middle Eastern historian. So my courses include a history of Islam, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the modern Middle East, and then I do a bunch of all the world history courses. But they very much hired me as a Middle Eastern professor.
You're good. So let's talk for a moment about this part of the world in general, and in particular, the challenges it poses in terms of knowing its history and the specifics of that and interpreting certain events and so on. First of all, when we're talking about really ancient history in the Middle East, I'm curious how much we can know, and of that we do know, how do we know it? I mean, what are the sources we look to understand the earliest recorded history of this part of the world?
So I teach a course on ancient world history and start with the Middle East. And it's a really fun course to teach. It's not my specialty, but I love teaching it. And there's always more to learn. So if we look at, you know, the first writing we have comes from Mesopotamia and from Egypt around the same time. So we're talking 3000 BCE, about the same time as cities emerge. Mm. And so we have, I mean, Mesopotamians, we have so many of these cuneiform tablets, just piles and piles and piles of them. So ancient Mesopotamia scholars have a lot to work with. And the hieroglyphs in Egypt that Egyptians love to make records of, especially of their wars and their historic feats, but they have lots of records as well. So we do have a lot of sources. Court records are really useful for trying to understand kind of social history, kind of bottom-up history, like about ordinary people. So we have a lot of those for both Mesopotamia and Egypt as well.
Very good. And by the way, when we're talking about the Middle East, how do you like to think about that geographically in terms of how far to the east, how far to the west do we sweep? I mean, at what point does the term Middle East begin to sort of lose its meaning? What is the region which, in a sense, kind of holds together in some ways and should be thought of collectively as the Middle East?
So typically, we consider Arabic-speaking countries. So we're talking the Levant, so what's now Israel-Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq. Iraq's not really part of the Levant, but that's included in the Middle East. All of the Arabian Peninsula, but also Egypt. Sometimes North Africa, rest of North Africa is also thrown in. I mean, usually we include North Africa as well, so we go all the way over to Morocco. And I wish we had some maps here because maps are super helpful. And then we also include like Turkey, even though it's not Arab and they speak Turkish. Turkey's also included in the Middle East, so that's always a big part of my modern Middle East class. And then Iran, and that Iranians are, you know, not Arab. Don't call an Iranian an Arab. They speak Farsi or Persian, and so they are. That's also included. But then since 2000, with the U.S.'s wars in Afghanistan. Then Afghanistan is usually often thrown in as well, but mostly just because, I guess, of U.S. policy. Afghanistan's really Central Asia, if we think about it. Mm. But it often gets, I usually include it in my classes because, the U.S. has been so involved there.
Right. So when we look at this part of the world, it is really easy to think of it as a place that is just rife with conflict. Mm-hmm. I mean, just perpetually in conflict, neighbor against neighbor, year after year, just in intractable conflict of one kind or another, and in a sense, the sands shift. Not to make a pun there, but I mean, sometimes friends become enemies, and so on. So it's just seems like a conflict-riven region, and yet I know from the description of your presentation on February 8th that one of the things you want to talk about is how it has not always been so, that we can look at certain periods of Middle Eastern history and we see neighbors coexisting very peacefully, even amicably, with one another. Can you kind of sketch for us sort of a general summary of this region in terms of that? And if this really intense level of conflict that we have all become so familiar with, how relatively rare that has been when we really take the long historical view.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think that's a really important point to make. And it's a really, it's one of the great tragedies of this, of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, is that historically, Jews, Muslims, and Christians have actually gotten along very well in the Middle East. So I'm talking about Ottoman Palestine as well as the rest of the Arab world. There was a great deal of coexistence. So we always think about anti-Semitism when we think about Jewish history, but most anti-Semitism was in Europe and in Russia. And it was very, very, it was really awful for Jews in Europe and Russia. Going back to, even Christian doctrine up until the 1960s considered the Jewish people responsible for the death of Christ. And so, like, up until the 1960s. And then there were pogroms in the Russian Empire. Jews were kicked out of England, France, Spain, entirely. So it was very awful. But a lot of them found refuge, especially those who were kicked out of Spain, found refuge in the Ottoman Empire. Where they were not always, they were not exactly equal, but they were not persecuted for the most part, and there was a great deal of coexistence. For Israel, Palestine, Christians, Jews, Muslims lived side by side, extremely well together, up until the conflict started, which is sometimes framed as being this age-old, centuries-old conflict, but really only goes back to, we could either date it at 1917 with Britain's Balfour Declaration. The earliest you could date it would be the 1880s with Jewish immigration into Palestine with the Zionist movement. Before that, really, there was a great deal of coexistence. We have a lot of sources on this. I'll talk about some of those in my talk, but just to briefly mention one diary that we have from a Palestinian who was an oud player, which is that kind of lute-like looking instrument in the Middle East. He was a Palestinian Christian. He played his oud in his brother's cafe and at weddings. And he describes how he had many Jewish friends. He describes holidays and festivals where Jews, Muslims, Christians would get together and celebrate together. I mean, he had a lot. His family was friends with many Sephardic Jewish families. So, and the Sephardic Jews, they spoke Arabic. By the way, Sephardic refers to Jews who came. Their ancestors were kicked out of Spain. Mizrahi Jews refers to Middle Eastern Jews, but they're often conflated. The indigenous Jews of Palestine, they spoke Arabic. They're culturally were very similar to Arabs. In fact, Avi Schleim, who is a historian in Britain, his family, so he was born in Baghdad, and then his family went to Israel when he was 5 years old. He calls himself an Arab Jew because he said they spoke Arabic at home exclusively. His family was very well, Jews were very well integrated into Baghdad up through the 1940s even. But nationalism is what tore the Jewish and Arab families apart. If we can point a finger, it was really the rise of nationalisms.
And when do we see that happening and why?
So not so much, he actually describes his family as being part of, and he, by the way, he has a memoir out this past summer that's fascinating, which I can't remember the name of it. Avi Schleim, so AVISHLAIM. I started reading it, haven't gotten very far, but it's fascinating. So he describes his family being part of even Iraqi nationalism. It's really when we get the State of Israel that things start to become very problematic for Jews living in other countries of the Middle East. for a variety of reasons. There's some push factors or some pull factors. There are different circumstances, but you do have a lot of Middle Eastern Jews going to Israel after its founding. Israel's trying to get them there, by the way. So they're actually giving them incentives to go. A lot of them don't want to leave. Some of them are pushed out. Others are just, you know, they are kind of, they see there are some riots that take place in their countries, so they feel like they need to go. But a lot of them, you know, are very sad about leaving their homes.
Mm. We're speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Brownson, Associate Professor of History at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. 2 weeks from today, that is Thursday, February 8th, she is giving a presentation with the program Adventures in Lifelong Learning on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Even looking more widely than specifically the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, there have, of course, been plenty of other conflicts that have arisen in this part of the world. And my very vague understanding is that at least some of that has to do with outsiders creating boundaries, creating borders, maybe in some respects rather arbitrarily designating this will be a country and this will be a country and here's where the border will be, and often for somewhat self-serving reasons having done that. Does that sound like kind of a sensible summary of at least some of the issues that this part of the world is dealing with to this very day?
Absolutely. So the borders were artificial constructions. You know, before World War I, we had the Ottoman Empire as the in charge of most of the Middle East, not all of Arabia, but certainly the holy cities. And they're kind of nominally in charge of Egypt because the British have come into Egypt at that point. So the borders that we know today were constructed by mostly the British. The French helped a little bit in the post-war settlements after World War I. So sometimes Jordan, the borders of Jordan, if you look at it, has this really weird little jig to it. Sometimes that's referred to as Churchill's hiccup because he was drunk as he drew the line and then he hiccuped. It's probably a myth, but I mean, it really was arbitrary. The way that these lines were drawn, they serve the interests of the British and the French, not the local populations. So the French really wanted to control Syria and Lebanon after the war. The British had already occupied Palestine during the war. They also wanted Iraq and occupied Iraq during the war because of the oil there. They knew there was to be oil found. And then Jordan, they wanted Jordan because they could then have a road at the time they were thinking of a railroad, but it eventually became a road from the Mediterranean to the Gulf. That was the shortest land route from the Mediterranean to the Gulf. So they wanted to have, so if you can envision a map in your head, you have the British in Palestine and then Jordan, then Iraq. The borders were very much drawn with imperial interests in mind. And then Iraq is, you know, as many people probably know, that it was all, you had three Ottoman administrative provinces that were put together to form Iraq. You know, the northern province that has Mosul was mostly had a lot of Kurds in it, majority Kurdish. Then you had a lot of Shia in one of the other provinces and a lot of Sunnis, and they were all kind of pushed together. So yes. The borders were not drawn with very much consideration for locals, if any.
Right. Nor understanding of them.
Right. Absolutely.
And certainly with, it would seem, very little anticipation of what the problems could be when, for instance, you're forcing rival tribes together to function as a single nation. You know, as you're speaking, Professor Brownson, I'm realizing how little I know about the Ottoman Empire. And I have a feeling I'm far from unique.
No, you're absolutely not
right.
Unique.
And of course, you know, a lot of us walk around knowing a fair amount about, for instance, the Roman Empire and the Greek, but the Ottoman Empire, my understanding is, you know, was of sprawling significance and for a long, long
absolutely.
Time. Just give us kind of a general sense of the scope of the Ottoman Empire, certainly at its peak, and then what led to its, in a sense, disappearance from the scene in the early 20th century.
Sure. So it started around 1300. So the Ottomans are Turkish or Turkic in their ethnicity. Originally, their ancestors were from Central Asia. And you had around 1000 of the Common Era or so, you had the series of Turkic migrations from Central Asia towards to the west. So we have actually some Turkic sultanates and empires like the Seljuks you might have heard of in the medieval period. You have a couple others. The Ottomans are, and you actually had several of these kind of short-lived Turkic dynasties. The Ottomans were the most successful. So starting around 1300. So they, and by the way, as the their Turkic ancestors made these migrations to the west, they converted to Islam. So it's a Turkic empire. It's Muslim, Sunni Muslim. They are very long lasting. I mean, they last for 600 years up until World War I. The height is usually considered under Suleiman the Magnificent. That's when the Middle Eastern provinces are conquered and integrated into the empire. What else can I tell you? Oh, I had this professor in college who loved to say the Ottoman Empire was not the weak man of Europe, because there was always this kind of conventional wisdom about the empire is that it had this long decline over several centuries. But what really happened is Europe got very strong, and the Ottomans were just not able to keep up. Part of the reason it endured as long as it did is because they called this in the 19th century the Ottoman question among the European powers. What would happen if it fell apart? They didn't want to have another reason to fight. They didn't want to fight over it, so they propped it up, but also meddled. I guess Russia is probably the best example of meddling into the Ottoman Empire by helping Serbia get independence, for example. The British helped Greece get independence. So the European powers were helping different groups get independence and start to carve up the empire a bit, or at least take off parts of territory during the 19th century. But the Ottomans, you know, they did adapt. They had a big series of reforms in the 19th century called the Tanzimat, which means reorganization, where they started to secularize their law. They actually secularized a great deal of their laws, with the exception of family law. They had a constitution, so they had a parliament. These were kind of short-lived because the Ottoman Sultan decided that he would rather just be in charge. But you did have a lot of attempts, very, very important reforms that took place. So ultimately, they chose poorly when it came to World War One. They chose, and to be fair to them, the Germans gave them much better terms than the Allies did. So, and Germany seemed like the least imperialistic of the great powers, because they hadn't interfered with the Ottomans before. Russia, Britain, France, they had done a great deal of interference. So, you know, the Ottomans were a little hesitant to trust them. The Germans gave them a better deal. They were willing to provide a lot of financing for the Ottomans for their support. So for them, it was kind of a no-brainer. So they chose poorly when it came to World War I.
They chose the wrong side.
Exactly.
They chose the losing side of history in this case. I'm curious about the interest of outsiders in this part of the world, because obviously that interest now, this ferocious interest and often, in a sense, counterproductive interest, it has to do with oil. All of the oil that one finds in this region, and we and others want it. But when we're talking about earlier in history, where oil was not of any great significance, you know, to anybody, what was the source of interest in terms of, for instance, Europeans with this part of the world? Or was it not particularly intense interest?
That's a great question. So a lot of it had to do with the peoples that were part of the Ottoman Empire. So Russia, for example, had a great interest in Orthodox and Serbians who were, you know, Orthodox Christians. France had a historic interest in the Maronite Christians of Lebanon, who are pretty much like Catholics. I mean, they have allegiance to the Pope. I don't see any huge differences doctrinally between Maronite Christians and Catholics, but we always call them Maronites. The Holy Land, access, pilgrims started going to Jerusalem in greater numbers, Christian pilgrims going to Jerusalem. So you're right. Before oil, there wasn't a great deal of interest. And it's really not till about 1900, the British Army converts from coal to oil, I think around 1910 under Churchill. And the Navy converts. The U.S. starts to do around the same time. So then oil becomes a very big deal. Absolutely. And oil is discovered in Iran, I think in 1904. There was a big concession. The Iranian Shah gave a huge concession to this guy named DRC, an Australian British guy who he got the deal. He was able to control all aspects of oil production. But before he could make any money, he went bankrupt. So the British bought the deal, bought the concession, and that became BP. Eventually.
Right. I was just going to say, every time we pull
every
up,
every time
to
you
a,
fill up,
yeah, every time we pull up to a BP station, we're stepping back into the history of this part of the world. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today with Dr. Elizabeth Brownson, an associate professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, who clearly has an expertise in Middle Eastern history, and she's going to be giving a presentation 2 weeks from today, on Thursday, February the 8th, for Adventures in Lifelong Learning. And that course is going to focus very specifically on Israeli-Palestinian conflict as it is currently playing out, but of course taking kind of a long historical view of that. Ahead of us, just digging into a little bit of those specifics, I'd be curious to have you talk about the most common ways in which you think we as Americans, for instance, tend to misunderstand this part of the world, and maybe the ways in which we frame our conversations about the Middle East in maybe ways that, first of all, do the region and its people disservice and maybe don't lead to us really properly understanding this part of the world.
Yeah, that's hard to know where to start. There are a lot of misunderstandings. And just a lot of, you know, a lot of facts and that people are not aware of when it comes to both Israel, Palestine, and the Middle East in general. I think there's a tendency to see the entire Middle East as this big homogenous block because people speak Arabic. And actually, as we talked about, like not everyone in the Middle East speaks Arabic. In Turkey and in Iran, they speak entirely different languages. But just because they all speak, you know, the rest of the parts of the Middle East that speaks Arabic does speak the same language. They're culturally very different. They're very different conditions economically, politically, socially. It's actually a very diverse region. And so that is often kind of missed. As far as Israel-Palestine, you know, like I said before, it's not a centuries-old conflict. It actually is quite recent, a little 100 years, a little bit more, not much longer than that. I guess another thing is, as far as Israel-Palestine, is it's sometimes framed as this conflict between two states, whereas the Palestinians don't have a state. It's sometimes referred to as a state, but it is not at all a state. So it's a very asymmetrical conflict. Israel is not just one of the strongest militaries in the world. I think it's one in the top 15 for a very small population. But it's also a major arms exporter. You know, it's in the top 10 as far as arms exporters. It's a competitor of the U.S. as far as arms exporting. It's a nuclear power, whereas the Palestinians don't have a state, don't have a military. They have some guerrilla groups. That's about it. I think that is sometimes in the news coverage, especially like the news channels on television, is just not really, that's not, it just seems to be lost.
Right. That is glossed over.
Exactly.
I think you're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. It's like the time is not taken to kind of make that point of clarification. So you've already kind of touched on maybe the root of this current conflict, which has to do with the establishment of Israel as a state and some displacement, which of course occurred in the wake of it. Tell us more about this thing called Gaza that we hear so much about. What exactly Gaza is, exactly its relationship with the nation of Israel, and why this is, in a sense, the hot spot in terms of the conflict that is playing out right now.
Okay, that's a great question. I should back up a little bit and just make pretty explicit that one of the biggest consequences for Palestinians from the 1948 war was 750,000 refugees, Palestinian refugees, who were forced out or fled out of fear from their homes by the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, when Israel was created. So Gaza, this has to do with Gaza, 80% of Gaza's population, they were refugees or descendants of refugees. So so Gaza and the West Bank are where the majority of the refugees fled. There are large populations of refugees and their descendants in Jordan and Syria and Lebanon. So those are the most, that's where most of them went. But then you also have a Palestinian diaspora in the West. The UN General Assembly issued a declaration that the Palestinian refugees should be able to go back to their homes. Israel was very opposed to letting that happen because then they would lose their Jewish majority. So they have never been compensated or given the choice to go back. So this is probably the biggest Palestinian grievance as far as this conflict. And then Gaza came under the control of Egypt after 1948, up until 1967. The West Bank came under the control of Jordan for that period. Gaza has always been kind of a hotbed of resistance. It's always been something that Israeli security concerns are kind of a... So, like, from that period, from 48 to 67, there were groups in Gaza that tried to either attack Israel from there. So that's always been a concern of Israel. And then in 1967, we have the Six-Day War, the June War, in which Israel conquered the West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, and the Golan Heights, and the Sinai Peninsula. And so then Gaza came under Israeli military rule, and the West Bank as well. But Gaza has, you know, it's a very densely populated place. So if we look at Gaza before October 7th, I think one thing that's not always understood, I think we probably all heard the stat, it's 50% children. That's one thing the media has been talking about, which is true. So 2.3 million Palestinians living there in a very small area. I've got some great maps that show you how big Gaza is compared to some U.S. cities that I'll show in my talk. But it's about, it's a third of the size of L.A. I mean, L.A. is a little, kind of a big city, but still, it's a city.
Right.
It's maybe two times as big as Washington, D.C., like just the borders of that. So it's very densely populated, especially Gaza City, or at least it used to be before Israel forced everyone to leave. But Gaza City was more densely populated than parts of New York City. So super densely populated. 80% refugees or descendants, 50% children. The economy had become so terrible for Palestinians since Israel imposed a siege since 2007 that 75% of Gazans didn't have enough food to feed their families month to month. So there was actually an Arab Barometer survey done right before October 7th, like it ended on October 6th in Palestine, asked Palestinians these kind of questions. So people were, and this was up from just a couple of years, from 2021, where it was 50% of people were food insecure. I mean, so that's a big problem for people. The other thing that's interesting about the Arab Barometer survey that was done is that most people were very unsupportive of Hamas. 67% of Palestinians had no too little trust in Hamas as a governing regime, which I think says a lot. People were not supportive of Hamas. So when you hear certain folks on And the media blaming all of Gaza for what happened on October 7th, that's just simply not true. Most people did not support Hamas. There was also little support for the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, which has increasingly been seen as just corrupt and just kind of Israel's security subcontractors in the West Bank. So on both sides, very little. For Hamas in Gaza and the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, Palestinians had very little faith in either one.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing to know about Gaza is that, like I said, since 2007, Israel has imposed a siege, which means that people can't go in and out. Palestinians haven't been able to export anything. And this has been very traumatic for their economy. This has been just devastating for their economy. Unemployment is at 50% for adults, and it's even higher for the youth. It's something like 70-75% for people in their 20s. During the Great Depression, I think it was, 25%, and we thought that was awful. So just imagine 50% unemployment. So people just, they have very little hope for the future. And this is all before October 7th. And I guess these are just things that are probably not very well understood about Gaza. I think there might have been one other thing. Oh, the other thing about the survey was that they asked if there were elections held today, who would you vote for? Hmm. Only 1 in 4 said they would vote for the leader of Hamas in Gaza. So 1 in 4. So really low support for Hamas. So we really can't blame all Palestinians for what Hamas did on October 7th.
Wow. I guess that's one thing, and we've touched on this already, is that in our haste, we tend to make sweeping generalizations, mm-hmm. and it is really it's such a mistake to do that. What else can you tell us about Hamas and how it operates? And in a sense, I think you've already given us a sense of the desperate situation there, which I don't mean to say it justifies, but
right.
it helps explain
right.
Some of the actions that Hamas has taken. What else is helpful for us to know about this organization?
Good, great question. Big question. So Hamas was formed, it was established during the first Palestinian Intifada. And Intifada literally means shaking off. So it's an uprising against the Israeli occupation that had been going on since 1967. I mean, occupation meaning military rule, okay? So Hamas, the PA, the Palestinian, wasn't the PA at the time, the PLO, so Yasser Arafat's organization, had been gradually moving towards putting down their arms since the 1970s, really. Putting down their arms, recognizing Israel, accepting a two-state solution, and they came out with an official statement, which was the Palestinian Declaration of Independence in 1988. So they officially denounce violence, they officially recognize Israel, they officially say that they are willing to accept 22% of historic Palestine. So because that's what the West Bank and Gaza is. If you look at the whole map of all of it, that's 22%, which I think is not often acknowledged, that that's, for them, that was a huge concession.
Hmm.
Previously, the PLO had been advocating for one democratic state in all of Israel-Palestine. So for them to go from that to saying, okay, we will accept a state in 22%, that was a big deal. Hamas was against this. Hamas thought that there should be resistance to Israeli military rule, that they should use armed resistance. So it very much kind of fills in for what the PLO used to use armed resistance. Now, Hamas is saying we're going to take up that banner. Hamas was against the Oslo Accords and the peace talks that happened in the 1990s. They thought Israel couldn't be trusted. That's when we start seeing suicide bombings in Israel, and we then see crackdowns. Not just by the IDF, the Israeli forces, but also the PA is established with Oslo. So you have PA security forces that are established to crack down on Palestinians for Israel. Hamas a lot of it's being made about, like, their winning elections in 2006. I think a lot of people have heard about this. So Hamas, they start off as this resistance group using armed resistance. They kind of, at some point in 2005, decide they will run in Palestinian elections in 2006. So that's a big shift for them, going from a, you know, guerrilla group to now trying to also become a political group. They are forced to moderate. Now it sounds kind of absurd, but at the time they were actually forced to moderate their positions on a lot of things because they were focusing on governing. They're focusing on being a governing body for the Palestinians. So they kind of moved away from their initial charter. They focus on governing issues. They don't really focus much on Israel at the time when they were running in these elections. They do win, but it's not a landslide. It's actually about a plurality of about 44%. And so I should also mention that half of Gaza was not alive at the time when those elections took place. So 44%. A lot of the reason Palestinians supported them was more because it was a vote against the PA and the PLO. Not so much for Hamas. They were sick of the PA for its corruption. They felt like Oslo got them nowhere. That Oslo actually got them more occupation and more intense occupation. Before Oslo, there was actually freedom of movement between the West Bank, Gaza, and Israel. There were really most Palestinians could go just about anywhere they wanted within Israel, Jerusalem, from the West Bank and Gaza. There was not restrictions on movement. With Oslo, that changed. And all of a sudden, you have Israel started building checkpoints, and the parts of the West Bank would be closed. And Gaza, you have the permits are required for them to go into Israel. There were a ton of Palestinian workers from both Gaza and the West Bank before Oslo as well. Those jobs dried up. Israel started bringing in Southeast Asians and others to do the low-wage labor. Basically, that's kind of a long way of saying Oslo got nothing for Palestinians but more occupation. And the PA, they held the PA responsible. So the PA had done nothing for them. The Hamas was kind of their only other option. It was either kind of the PA or Hamas. Also, Hamas had won a lot of respect at the time because they provided a lot of social services. So this is kind of a big trend amongst and a big characteristic of Islamist movements in general, but also applies to Hamas. It's just applying all these services, you know, hospitals, healthcare, food banks, charity. So that's what Palestinians were attracted to.
Essentials for human life.
Exactly. Especially in Gaza, where things had gotten gradually worse since Oslo. They weren't as you know, dire as what I described earlier, right before October 7th, but things had already gotten pretty bad in Gaza, and Hamas was stepping up. The PA was seen as kind of not caring.
Yeah. Well, I think you've done a great job of kind of helping us understand the situation there, rising tensions, rising desperation, and of course, the dramatic attacks and responses and so on, and the very quick escalation in terms of the conflict. What do you see in terms of a path forward here? And are there paths to the rebuilding of some kind of peace? What could that possibly look like? And what could that look like?
It's really... Right now, it's really hard to say. You know, I think we're at 24,000 Palestinians have been killed since October 7th, plus thousands more under the rubble. So we're looking at, you know, just it, and it doesn't sound like Israel is willing to cease these bombardments anytime soon. I mean, I think at some point Biden will have to just tell them to stop. It's going to have to come on him to eventually stop the carnage. You know, the majority of American voters have said they think a ceasefire is a good idea. And I don't think a ceasefire is saying you're anti-Israel. I think it's just saying you're pro-human life. So I think at some point Biden's going to have to, he's going to have to say that's enough. Because the thing is, there's no military solution to this conflict. It's going to have to be a political, diplomatic solution, really. I mean, you can't, even if Israel conquers every inch of Gaza, that doesn't eradicate some of the ideologies. Even if Hamas is eradicated, there's going to be another group that comes up. Until there is a solution to ending the siege, ending the military rule of the West Bank and Gaza, then there's going to be continued conflict. So there's got to be a political solution. I think one kind of, silver lining is that Netanyahu is likely to be out as soon as this thing's over, because he's on trial for corruption charges. And those, he's going to have to face the music once he's out. His coalition has been so extreme. I mean, he's got ministers in his cabinet that have openly called for the ethnic cleansing of the West Bank and Gaza before October 7th. So, this current government, I don't see much hope for peace. But, this government's going to fall as soon as this conflict's over. And then hopefully we can get some leaders in there that are serious. Because really, it comes down to leadership. A lot has been said about the failures of Oslo and Camp David. But they actually accomplished a great deal. They came very, very close. But then they had no leadership to keep them going.
Right. So, I mean, a lot of times the brokering of an agreement is just the first step.
Right.
And we don't always understand that it's in the follow through, the execution, that a true lasting peace is created. And for various reasons, that just hasn't happened.
And it's hard work. And there's not always a political payout. And you have to have leaders who are willing to do that hard work.
Right.
And we just haven't seen that since 2000.
Well, I appreciate all that you've shared. I'm astonished at the breadth and depth of your understanding of this really complicated part of the world. And for those that seek out your presentation on the 8th of February, I know that there is still more that you will be sharing. And we encourage people to go to Parkside's website, uwp.edu, and there you can find the page devoted to adventures in lifelong learning, and we'll find registration information for this and other offerings that they have. Dr. Elizabeth Brownson, Associate Professor of History at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, I am so glad to make your acquaintance and to have had this opportunity to learn so much from you about this important part of the world. And I really thank you for visiting the morning show. I hope there'll be more visits in the future.
Absolutely. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you.
Once again, a reminder that more information about Professor Bronson's one-day class for Adventures in Lifelong Learning can be found by going to Parkside's website, uwp.edu. Tomorrow on the morning show, I'll be speaking with the author and illustrator of a brand new, wonderful children's book called Arlo Needs Glasses. And after that, from the archives, a conversation with best-selling author Robert Courson, his book Crashing Through, telling the true story of a man once blind who is able to see, and what a transformative but difficult experience that turns out to be. On Monday, Time magazine correspondent Simon Schuster and his extraordinary new book called The Showman, Inside the Invasion That Shook the World and Made a Leader of Vladimir Zelensky, who is, of course, the leader of Ukraine. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Let's take a look at our weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois. It is a dreary and rather monotonous forecast, I'm afraid. Cloudy with more light rain and fog today, a high of 40 degrees. Rain and fog tonight, low of 35. Cloudy and mild tomorrow with a high of 40. Cloudy skies are in our extended forecast all the way through next Wednesday. And along with the clouds, mild temperatures right around 40 degrees for a daytime high each and every day. Right now we show temperatures of 39 degrees both in Racine and Kenosha. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha.